So anyway, this first picture here is something I took from the Human Genome website, and I just like to use it to show how, now we have the sequence of the bulk of our genomic DNA, and one of the things that reveals is many tens of thousands of genes that we specify the information to make us what we are. And so, you know, where do you want to go from here? Well, I think there's a number of maybe, you know, somewhat obvious things to do. One of the things is to figure out what each of the gene products does. But also, at least from my area of interest, what we're interested in is how each of those genes is regulated. Because what makes a cell what it is having the right genes on to the right extent, the right genes on, the right genes off. And so really pretty much what controls what the fate of each cell is the proper expression of each of its tens of thousands of genes. And so that is an information problem. And one of these days, you know, we may be able to know, perhaps by just looking at the sequence, you know, this gene is going to be on the liver and on off in the brain and all those sorts of things, and what sort of signals will turn the genes on and turn them off. And maybe one of these days we'll know that. But that's something of, I like to think of it as like a gene expression code. And so one of these days I think we'll eventually solve that gene expression code. And what sort of things can we do today to try to get to the understanding of that code? And at least what we do in that area is try to understand the basic mechanisms by which genes are regulated. And so if we can understand the processes that are occurring in the regulation of gene expression, then I think that would be one big step forward toward understanding how all these different genes are regulated. Okay, so anyway, like I said, this is just what I like to think of as, I like to start off with something of a big picture. And so that's more or less the big picture, leaving us with really one of the key questions is how do you regulate, how does the cell properly regulate all those tens of thousands of genes? Now, I know you might have had some of this sort of stuff already, but I'd like to just show you some of the things that are going on in a little bit about what we know about the regulation of gene expression at the level of transcription. And so here first we have what we like to think of as the cis elements. This is just the DNA, what's encoded in the DNA. And I think most people, I like to break, when I think about what's in the DNA that affects transcription, I like to break into at least three parts. You've got something called the core promoter here. And the core promoter is typically about 40 nucleotides or so. It's a very small piece of DNA. It's not very big. And it just contains enough information to tell the polymerase machinery to start transcription. It's literally just this arrow. It just means start here. And so that's the core promoter. Like I said, it's a relatively small stretch of DNA, about 40 nucleotides. There are a few known core promoter motifs. I think you probably might already heard of something called the TATA box. That's usually located about 20 to 30 nucleotides upstream of the start site. That's a TATA rich region, hence called TATA box. Then encompassing the start site is something called the initiator motif. And then there's another motif here downstream called the DPE, the downstream core promoter element. That's also another core promoter motif. In fact, these two are a bit redundant in a sense, where in other words, for basal transcription activity, if you have this, you don't need this, the DPE. If you have the DPE, you don't need a TATA for basal activity. However, I might point out that the core promoter, which as a whole people tend to think of as kind of this somewhat kind of mundane element that just serves the kind of simple purpose of telling polymerase to start is actually more complicated than that. Some promoters, for instance, you might have like two common classes of core promoters would have might be dependent on either a Tata box or a DPE. And what one thing we've shown, in fact, recently that's not published is that these elements up here, these are called enhancers. These regulate transcription from many kilobases away. Some enhancers will work with if you have a Tata but not the DPE, or others will be specific for core promoters that have a DPE but not a Tata. So in other words, the core promoter is also an important part of the proper regulation of a gene, because things like enhancers, which contain binding sites for activators that can be located many tens of kilobases away from the start site, some enhancers do care whether they'll either work or not work depending upon whether you have a Tata or a DPE motif.
So for genes that are Tata-less, is TBP actually used, though?
That's actually not known. It's not known whether or not you really need TBP for those. It's known that you don't need the Tata. Of course, you don't need TBP to bind. But whether or not you actually need the TBP protein there itself is an unknown question. My guess is that if you've talked a little bit about TF2D, TF2D comprises TBP and the TAFs, and that's about maybe 11 subunits or so. I'm guessing that you probably need TBP just as a component, as a maybe minimally just a structural component of TF2D. But it's actually the experiment there has not been an experiment done that actually truly addresses that question, whether you need TBP for Tata-less transcription. It's one of those experiments that we've considered doing ourselves, but it's one of those things where I think it's a good question, but it takes the amount of time it would take to do it. It's kind of like the investment return sort of issue. Is it worth someone spending a year to get that answer or not? It probably is, but we just haven't done it. So this is the core promoter. So remember, it just tells you where to start, but it's more important. It actually has more to do with the regulation than I think a lot of people think. That there is a proper match between. You have to have the right match between enhancers and core promoters. Immediately upstream of the core promoter is usually a site where you can see a variety of binding sites for sequence-specific DNA binding factors. And this is often referred to as the proximal promoter. You'll often find different types of factors binding to the proximal promoter than to enhancers. And why would you need this? It may be that there may be some sort of part of communication of enhancers. This also may be an important part of enhancer communication as well. But there's really no clear data on that. And then enhancers are located, as I said, they can be located many tens of kilobases away, 80 kb or more away from the start site. They can be located upstream or downstream of the start site. And enhancers are pretty much the key. They contain the key information for where a gene should be on, where and when genes should be on. Genes are pretty much controlled. This is pretty much where, when you want to funnel in the information into where a gene should be turned on and when and to what extent, it's going through the enhancer. So really, gene activity is controlled by enhancers. Yes.
So this is a big distance of 80. That you mentioned, could there be another gene in between?
There could be a lot of things in between. Yeah, and also enhancers can even be downstream of the start too. So you can actually have very complicated situations with many things like another gene in between an enhancer and a start site. So one question is how does the enhancer know, where the core promoter is? The core promoter is a relatively simple motif, just 40 nucleotides. So how does it find the right core promoter? And so, yes?
So if you've got some protein binding to these enhancers, and so then there will be several of these promoters. Can it promote or enhance a number of a different?
Well, actually, they exhibit some specificity. And so that's where, this matching with the core promoter is actually makes sense, because if you have if the core promoter has a little bit, if you're using more of the information in core promoter to help form a match.
But let's say we stick with the Tata type of promoters.
Okay.
So if there's so within 80,000 phases, if there's two or three different Tata type promoters,
The fact is that enhancers tend to act, there's not a lot of data on this, but they tend to act pretty specifically. Like you can put other genes in between and they won't get turned on. Well, some will and some won't, you know what I mean? Okay, not all will, okay?
And then which promoter to interact is from the loop or?
Well, how enhancers find this is, I actually have a few things on that we could either discuss now or I could discuss maybe later on, but later in the thing. No one really knows. The most popular model is that you form a loop between the enhancer and the core promoter. And so that's the most popular model. I think it makes some amount of sense, but it really hasn't been proven. Yes.
So can't people do like some sort of experiment where they tag both the enhancer and the core and just see if they're always near each other or whether they only become near each other at a regulation point?
I think it's probably theoretically possible to start to do that sort of thing. If you had an enhancer that's really located very far away from the core promoter, you might be able to.
Like a fluorescent.
Yeah, you might be able to if you had one of these enhancers that's located far away. I haven't seen anybody do anything like that, but I suppose I think that could be possible to tag those two pieces and then look and see if they actually are in proximity. The other thing is that it may be that they sometimes you'll have one enhancer or enhancer-like element also affecting multiple genes too. There's something called a locus control region that's like a super enhancer that will kind of activate transcription over maybe around an 80 kilobase range, and there'll be four or five genes that are controlled by the locus control region. And so how does this one locus control region, which is like a super enhancer, influence all these different genes? And the way that the available data argue that it kind of does one at a time, okay, that the enhancer will come by and do gene A, then it'll do gene B, then it'll do gene C, they'll kind of do them, but in other words, it can't do them all at once. It can only be activating them one at a time. And for that sort of experiment, it's also, if you have an enhancer, if you have just more of a transient interaction that leads to each initiation event, you may not see a stable long-term sort of association. It might just be that it can come by, you get an initiation, and it might not be there also. So that experiment, even if it were to loop, you may or may not actually see that structure.
But the usual separation between genes is like 100,000 bases?
Usually enhancers are within a few kilobases of
so
genes.
It's much smaller distance than the separation between genes.
Well, it depends upon the organism. Some organisms have more compact gene structures, and also you might have clusters of genes and things like that. So, yeah, you know, genes, you know, since they're not pretty much, you know, you don't take a genome and divide it by the number of genes, right, sort of thing. Someone raised a question. I was going to make another comment. You might ask, why might you also have enhancers why would you have such flexibility in the distance between enhancers and the promoter? And I think one reasonable thing is maybe from a more evolutionary point of view, that if you wanted to bring in a new function of your gene, if you wanted to have your gene have a new place where it's expressed, then it's pretty easy just to put in, if you put in an enhancer kind of anywhere in the ballpark of that gene, you have a shot of that enhancer activating in that tissue. Right? And let's say if you had a gene that you wanted, wasn't on in the liver, but you wanted to, eventually there was some advantage to having it on the liver, if a liver-specific enhancer kind of landed in the ballpark vicinity of your gene, then that could influence that gene. So in other words, what you'll often find is that in enhancers, you might not just have just one enhancer, but you might have multiple enhancers that have specific different functions. You might have a brain-specific enhancer. You might have a liver-specific enhancer. You might have a kidney-specific enhancer in a gene. So you might have different islands they have specific functions for where the gene should be turned on in terms of.
Within the one group, if you change the order of the squares and the triangles, does it matter?
It can. There's a little bit of a paradox sometimes. Sometimes people will say, you can do anything you want to enhancers and they still work. You can flip them around, you can move them all around, and so forth, so on. On the other hand, sometimes you'll also see studies where people just move things a little bit and, you know, and then there'll be big effects. I think that there are some units where you need to have a certain arrangement of factors to make it an activating unit. But then once you have the activating unit, you can probably move that unit around a bit. That's probably why you can see both effects at the same time. So you may not, if you had a certain arrangement, you may not want to mess with that exact specific arrangement. But if you have that whole bit, the whole enhancer, I think that is a little more autonomous, I think. Okay, so anyway, I just first wanted to introduce you to the kind of the cis elements. I know that you've had some of that, but sometimes it doesn't hurt to see that maybe again, but maybe different perspective. Any questions about this? Okay, great. Now, this was something someone would have drawn maybe about 10 years ago or so, when you look at what's happening at a promoter. And so nowadays life is a little more complicated. People have been very busy. And you have this. And I like to call this the grand scheme right now. This has many, but not all of the things that are going on in eukaryotic transcription regulation. For the most part, I have to say that these processes are pretty well conserved from yeast to humans. So if you should have an interest in studying any organism ranging from yeast to humans, you'd pretty much, you could pretty much have the same sort of set of factors that you'd be thinking about and considering. I mean, if you consider something like a budding yeast like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that to humans, the yeast is a little further off in some ways, but still has essentially the same things. There might be just little slight differences in the arrangements of things. Now, let's look. I just want to. This is kind of the reason why I have this is not for you to try to memorize everything here all at once, but just to kind of have it as like it's like a map or something. You know what I mean? It's like a road map or a map of the United States or something, where you can see where different states are or something, and when you look at each state, and you know that's where it is. So I just wanted to have this as kind of like a reference point, let's say. So where when we talk about any individual factors, that you can kind of see, okay, oh yeah, that's that factor. So first, just kind of just give you a general overview of what we have here. We've got reassuringly under here, very quietly, we have the DNA still, and then here's our core promoter. And this is now with the basal transcription machinery on that, including the TF2D factor that we just talked about a second ago. Here are your sequence-specific DNA binding activators. I didn't have an enhancer drawn on this, but this is just more the proximal promoter region. And I didn't mention it, but I think you probably already can figure out or know that these sequence-specific DNA binding factors can function both as activators and as repressors, too. So you'll have sequence-specific activators as well as sequence-specific repressors. One big difference between this slide and the previous slide is that that now we have chromatin on the chromatin template here, now basically over the past 10 or so years, one thing that we've learned is that chromatin structure is an integral component of the regulation of genes, and sometimes. I don't know. I guess just being humans, we like to think of things from our own perspective. But there was a time when people would be very surprised to even think that chromatin might be involved in transcription. And the fact is that chromatin's been around for a long time, and so these factors have all kind of co-evolved with chromatin for many, many millions of years. So while humans might have been surprised that chromatin might be, there on the template, these factors are not at all surprised. They're not saying, what's this nucleosome doing here? They've been there, for many millions of years doing their working together as partners in the in the nucleus. So now we have chromatin. Now, in addition to these basic factors, we have the sequence of the DNA binding factors, the basal machinery. We have factors that are often called co-regulators or mediators or co-activators, co-repressors that facilitate communication between the activators and the basal machinery. You have factors that can directly regulate transcription via the basal machinery. You have factors that regulate transcription through chromatin, so that you have nucleosomes themselves under physiological conditions will not move. They're immobile on the time scale of at physiological salt and in the time frame at which you need mobility to occur. So the cell has a variety of factors called chromatin remodeling factors. That's kind of just the term. I don't know why it became that term, but they're called chromatin remodeling factors. These factors use ATP. We'll talk more about these later, but I'm just going to get this kind of more of an overview. They use the energy of ATP to mobilize nucleosomes. So whereas nucleosomes are intrinsically immobile on the time frame of in which they have to be moving for in a cell, you should think of them in vivo as mobile entities. In other words, think of nucleosomes as things that can move. If the nucleosome has to move, yeah, it will move because there's plenty of these factors around to mobilize them. Also, the properties of nucleosomes are affected by the post-translational modifications that occur on the histones as well. You probably already know, but each nucleosome has 8 histones, 2 copies each of histones H2A, H2B, H3, and H4. And so those histones are very rich, especially in what's called the tail regions, which are these unstructured regions that go beyond the globular core of the histone core. And those get extensively modified by acetylation, methylation, ubiquitination, phosphorylation, and we'll talk more about that later. But what we have here is we have a variety of factors that included now in this are factors that acetylate histones. Those are generally thought to be activators. Factors that deacetylate histones, those are generally thought to be repressors. We have factors that methylate histones, some thought to be positive and negative. Factors that ubiquitinate histones, phosphorylate histones. So there's a whole bunch of things that's happening with the histones. And those factors do affect transcriptional activity, and so hence they would be, kind of in this general scheme of things as co-regulators as well. Yeah?
In order for the gene to be transcribed effectively, do all the histones need to be removed, like in this 80 kb region between the enhancers and the gene, or can some of the histones still be there and sort of this loop around anyway?
Okay, yeah, in other words, where are the histones when you look at the structure of a chromatin structure of an active gene, you'll typically see some sort of disruption around the start site of the chromatin. And that's probably because, of course, you just simply can't fit the machinery and the histones there at the same time. So at least transiently, there's going to be some sort of disruption of that. But you also do see nucleosomes, in the transcribed region. You see nucleosomes upstream of the region. I'd say that the genes that have been looked at, in general, what you'll find is that when the gene is actively being transcribed, that there's some disruption here, but there are nucleosomes here and there around the promoter region. It's not like you need a large nucleosome-free region, but you'll find them usually not where the factors are bound. So in other words, if you have factors bound here, you might find nucleosome next to where the factors bind, but usually not exactly where they bind.
Okay.
even before it's transcribed.
Yeah.
The fact is that these small DNA segments that are usually reside in the linker region.
Before you can have inactive genes, and inactive genes will have a structure that actually sometimes doesn't, that looks almost the same as the active gene, except perhaps with a little bit of disruption around here. So yes, the fact is before you turn genes on, you will often have quite a few of these factors already bound to the template, and you'll have a fair amount of rearrangement of the chromatin structure. And I think one of the key things is that you'll probably have this region somehow inaccessible to the machinery, the start site. And yes?
How does the DNA know not to wrap, not to hide these transcription factor binding sites in the history?
Well, I think this is again one of those cases where these factors they have evolved to work with nucleosomes. Okay, so in other words, if you had this template fully just packaged in the nucleosomes, you'll probably find that a good chunk of these, maybe, you know, in fact, of the ones that we've studied, every one we've ever studied can bind to DNA packaged in the chromatin with almost the same efficiency as it can bind to free DNA. But these factors, that's not true for all of them. There are some factors that cannot do that. But many activators are perfectly able to bind to DNA that's packaged in a chromatin. In other words, that's just the natural way that they like to see the DNA. That's just how they're used to it. It's not a problem for them.
But in your picture, you don't show them sitting on any...
This is after they've already bound. After they've already bound, then thanks to the nucleosome mobilizing activities, they'll move aside, because it's just a lower, you know, lower energy state, whatever you need. But as a whole, there are many factors that combine readily to chromatin.
And there's no base pair specificity at all in the
nucleosome positioning?
Yeah.
That's been an issue that's been studied a fair amount. What's the relationship between the DNA sequence and the position of nucleosomes? And as far as I know, in vivo, just about any time you see a nucleosome position, it's positioned because of a factor that's bound. In other words, factor binding is probably accounts for most of the specific positioning you see of nucleosomes. In vitro, you can take a small piece of DNA, like 146 base pair. You know, if you take a short piece of DNA in vitro and put that on a nucleosome, you will see positioning that's kind of a function of the sequence, and that has to do with like the curvature of the DNA. So if you have a DNA that's a bent or curved DNA, then the nucleosomes like to form over the DNA where there's a curve, because you just have less bending or to do to wrap it around the nucleosome.
You're saying the bending rigidity is sequence dependent?
No, I'm talking about just the curvature of the DNA. If you have a curved DNA,
he's asking whether curvature is sequence dependent.
Yes, that is. Yeah. 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 So you can design it based on sequences like alternating A, T, G, C sort of sequences. So people have made synthetic DNAs which have a curvature in it, and then you form a nucleosome with that, and then it'll form much more readily over the curved DNA than it would over the straight DNA. And those pieces, so if you take a small fragment and have a curved fragment in it, then you'll find that the nucleosome will preferentially form over the curved piece over the, relative to a non-curved piece.
Sequence begets curvature, begets chromatin.
In a short in vitro experiment, yes. Okay, so the nucleosome will prefer forming over the curved fragment. But if you take that same curved fragment that works really well in vitro and put that into a cell, it doesn't work. It won't work. Okay, just...
But you say that the depletion independently depending on these other factors enable...
What was that?
You say that the depletion of nucleosome independently binding of other factors enable...
Yeah, in other words, yeah, I think that any time I've ever seen a nucleus on position in vivo, it's been because some factor put it, it's because it's sitting next to some other factor. In fact, there's actually one factor that's really well characterized, and that's called the alpha-2 repressor in yeast. They've done it, Bob Simpson did a very nice study where he just kind of moved this binding site for this factor, you know, around. And every time he moves it, the nucleosome goes right with it. You know what I mean? You know how you move it, okay? All right? So.
But how specific is alpha-2 receptor binding site? If it's very specific, then you can predict where the nucleosome.
You can. Oh, sure. In other words, in his studies, he definitely could. With his particular binding site that he was using, he was just putting the nucleosome wherever he wanted to with that binding site. And then, of course, what happens is that nucleosomes are in a periodic array, so if you have one set, then for at least a little while, you'll maintain some amount of periodicity beyond that, too. So anyway, this is, like I said, kind of the big picture of the things that are happening, this is kind of, you know, what kind of scares people off from sometimes in the transcription field now, is that you have a variety of factors. But I think it's just that, it's a tremendous task to have to control all those tens of thousands of genes, and it's very important to have it done correctly. And so I think just an enormous fraction of the genome and the energy of a cell is devoted toward the proper control of gene activity. And so that's why it is, unfortunately for those who are trying to understand it, it's a fairly complicated arrangement of factors.
Can you comment something about the methylation?
DNA methylation?
Yeah.
Okay. I think there are a lot of different ways of thinking about regulation. One is the simple genetic approach. You know, if you're thinking about regulation genetically, what I mean by that is that you're just looking at the pure sequence in the DNA, okay? And yes, there's a lot of regulation that's controlled purely by just the primary sequence in the DNA. But there's also what you'd call epigenetic effects. In other words, things that you can control gene expression also epigenetically. In other words, not through the primary sequence. And one example of that is by modification of DNA. Right, so that a modification of the DNA, such as by methylation, will also control gene activity. In that case, this is an example of an epigenetic effect. It's not the raw primary sequence, right? It's something that you do to DNA that can be maintained through multiple generations of cells that also affects gene expression. Methylation occurs in mammals, in plants. In plants it occurs, but the plant methylation story is not quite the same as the mammalian methylation story. I'll just tell you something like the mammalian methylation story. As a whole, methylation in mammals occurs at CG sequences. It's called CPG. They call it CPG. It's just CG motifs. And the C gets methylated at the position 5. Of the cytidine, and so you get what they call CPG methylation. And methylation, in general, correlates with repression. And an example of something that's heavily methylated would be you have XY and females are XX, right? So one of the female X chromosomes is inactivated, okay, because you don't want to have a double dose of the genes that are on the X. And so that the inactive X chromosome in females is heavily methylated. That's an example. And that's, see, the sequence is the same. Again, this is not genetic, it's epigenetic. It's not a genetic effect. And so there is important control occurring at the level. Methylation is an important mechanism for the control of gene activity. In this case, it's epigenetic. And the way that it's propagated is this, is that if you have both, let's say you start off, you have both strands methylated. Then you have a replication event. Now you'll end up with two hemimethylated strands. So the methylases in the cell methylate hemimethylated DNA as very well into the back, into the dimethylated form, right? And so that's how you can maintain methylation through replication. Okay, so in other words, if the enzyme is very good at methylating hemimethylated DNA, that's how you can keep the methylation state at wherever you have it methylated, and not just go methylating everything else in your genome. So methylation is a way that you can is really a beautiful system for maintaining a certain epigenetic state through multiple cell divisions.
And there's a methylation story for prokaryotes. You don't have to tell it to
us. In prokaryotes, it's a whole other story for methylation. But from the gene expression point of view, in mammals, the CpG methylation is what occurs. And there are factors that recognize the methylated DNA. So there are methyl DNA binding proteins that bind the DNA. And in fact, one thing that's known, for instance, is that one particular methyl DNA binding protein will then recruit in a histone deacetylase, that deacetylates histones, and then by that mechanism contribute to repression.
But what controls which section of the genome should be methylated and which not?
Well, that goes back to the chicken and egg sort of thing. You know, once you get, in other words, once you have it there already, then it's pretty much going to stay there. How exactly control kind of, de novo methylation, or how would you remove methylation? That actually we don't know.
Yeah. It typically occurs when you have GC pairs.
Well, the CpG regions.
The P doesn't count.
Right, just the CG, right? But everybody calls it CpG. I don't know why. It's just big C, little P, big G. But that's just
phosphate. But it's always like that. We shouldn't call it.
I know. We don't call it, G, P, A, P, whatever, right? But we have a lot of P's in our genome sequence if we did that. There are things like many mammalian promoters have what's called CpG islands. Yeah, I'm not the person to name these things, but they have CG rich regions upstream. So a lot of mammalian promoters are very CG rich, and so those are called CpG islands. And so those are
one methyl group per island.
Oh no, it's just many, many, many. Yeah, oh yeah. Clusters, heavy clusters.
So a big fraction of them are methylated.
Yes. You'll have 50 or more methylation events maybe in a half.
So when the cell divides, 25 or 30 will go on one strand and 20 will go on the other, these methyl groups?
Quite a few, yeah.
Okay.
The CG the CG is symmetrical, right? So you have it on both strands. So every time it divides, you're always going to have equal numbers. Yeah. Yes?
Could you say just one sentence as why methylation represses? Is it because the transcription factors cannot bind as effectively anymore to methylated DNA or something?
Okay. In fact, there's no reason why methylation had to be repressive. It just had to be, I think. In fact, original theories of methylation and gene regulation actually had methylation as an activator. It just turns out to be that as repressive. We don't know. We don't really know why it ended up being that way. It's just.
Would you think the binding is sort of less effective of the proteins in the DNA when it's methylated?
Let's go back to the
main. I don't really know. Sometimes it's one of those things where the chips are going to fall one way or the other, and it just fell that way. Yeah. 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 Okay. So anyway, this is the grand scheme, and if anybody has any questions out of this, I'll be happy to talk about that even more this afternoon. Okay. Now, I guess my understanding is that we're going to take a break at 2 and then resume at 3. And I just can go on all day, so I'm not going to. That's the plan goes.
We take a break at 2, a long break at 2, there's a colloquium going on.
Okay, now this is a list of the basal factors. I just felt that I'd like to just mention these You have your list of the factors there. I just, as a sake of completeness, I feel that I kind of have been negligent if I don't mention these. These are the factors that mediate the initiation process for transcription. I think you've talked about some of these. TF2D has TBP, tidal box binding protein, and TAFs. It's the binding of TF2D is the first step in the basal transcription process. TF2D is the main DNA recognition factor among the basal machinery. There's a factor called TF2A that increases TBP binding affinity to the tidal box, but it's actually not needed for transcription in vitro. So it's a, people think it's involved in transcription, but it binds to TBP and increases the binding, its affinity to the tata box. This is the order in which they assemble onto the template, by the way. That's why I have it in this order. This is the way that they fit on top of each other. TF2B, TF2A you can kind of omit or whatever. TF2B is just a factor, single polypeptide of 35 kilodaltons. It binds to TBP. Also has a little bit of interaction with DNA upstream of the tata box. And the D and B will form a semi-stable complex on the DNA. Next coming in will be the blue guys here. Polymerase and TF2F will come in. TF2F binds to RNA polymerase too. Also has another name of RAP3074. RAP stands for RNA polymerase associated proteins of 30 and 74 kilodaltons. And RNA polymerase 2, which you might have heard a little bit about already, has two large subunits. The largest subunit is conserved through throughout biology. It's analogous to the beta prime subunit of E. coli RNA polymerase. The second largest subunit is related to the beta subunit of E. coli RNA polymerase. So it has two large subunits. And those two largest subunits are conserved through, you know, living organisms. And then it has maybe around eight or so smaller subunits. Polymerase can, RNA polymerase 2 can make the RNA copy of the DNA template, but it cannot recognize a promoter by itself. That's why it needs all these other factors. Okay, it needs all these other factors to recognize the core promoter. It's got one, it has one unique feature, which is, have you guys talked about the CTD at all? Did anybody tell you about the CTD of the polymerase? The RNA polymerase 2, the largest subunit of RNA polymerase 2, as I said, is conserved with, you know, things like the E. coli beta prime subunit, but it's got one unique feature, which is that at C-terminus, it has this repeated motif here. This heptapeptide is repeated many times at the C-terminus of the RNA polymerase 2. Actually, that's a very important part of Pol II transcription, is this thing that they call the CTD for C-terminal domain. In mammals, you'll have 52 of these repeats at the C-terminus of the polymerase. There's 52 of these. It's not perfect, but, you know, fairly good. It's a repeat that's not perfect, but pretty well, you know, each of the motifs are pretty well conserved through those repeats. Drosophila, you'll have 42. Yeast will have 26. These are essential for life. If you chop them down, then if you, like in yeast, you can do these sorts of experiments. If you chop it down to like 12, the yeast will be dead. As you can see, there's serines, threonine serines in this motif, and it's heavily phosphorylated too. So the phosphorylation of CTD is an important part of the regulation of transcription.
What kind of motif
they call structure? I don't think anybody's determined that. It's probably not very structured because it's got two prolines in it too per heptapeptide. So it's probably pretty just. It's probably just
floppy around.
Yeah, probably somewhat unstructured. So it's highly phosphorylated, and actually the exact position of phosphorylation too does differ. Like different transcription factors are phosphorylated at, for instance, serine 2 versus serine 5 and things like that. So the position at which it gets phosphorylated is also important. So that's something to remember about RNA polymerase 2, and that's an important part of transcription by Pol II. And then you have a factor called TF2E, And all you really need TF2E for is to bring in TF2H. And TF2H is a 9-subunit complex. It has a kinase in it. It has so it can phosphorylate. In fact, TF2H is one of the proteins that phosphorylates the CTD, one of the many. And it also has two DNA helicases in it. It has a 3 to 5 prime helicase and a 5 prime to 3 prime helicase in it. And when you think about transcription, you need something to open up that DNA to allow the entry of the polymerase, right? So TF2H is what can do that.
Or how many proteins does this list contain? How many gene products?
Of what's that? Well, of these factors, this is about maybe 11 subunits. This is 3 subunits, 2 genes, 1. This is about 11 genes. This is 2, and that's 9.
It's about 40.
Yeah, just for this basic process, right.
So it's a little bit like a ribosome.
You can start thinking of it that way. I mean, it's you know, there's a lot of you need a lot of polypeptides to make this work. And then this is just the basic core process too. And so it you know, in terms of the overall number of polypeptides, we'll see if we take that grand scheme, right? Many of those things have multiple things. We're probably talking about 150 polypeptides, maybe more.
So it's a machine, an elaborate machine.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. I think it's about 2:00, so maybe this would be a good place to stop, and we'll just.
Okay, so we'll reconvene after.
Okay, I'm just going to first just mention a few things. Just go through something rather quickly, just to kind of just for the record. These are things that you can probably just read, but I thought it might be handy to have. These are just some properties of promoter enhancer binding factors or sequence-specific gene binding proteins. They're modular. In other words, they seem to be composed of modules, protein modules. They're DNA binding modules, activation repression modules, regulatory modules, so modules of the protein that could regulate the activity. It could be within the same or other proteins. And multimerization modules, so ways that can inform multimers, either hetero or homotypic interactions. Typically, your typical enhancer binding factor might be a member of a family of proteins that might be related. The binding sites occur in clusters, like in enhancers, for instance. Like I said, you have homo and heterotypic interactions. And as I mentioned before, some factors tend to be found more in enhancers and some tend to be found more in promoters. That's just the kind of roundup that we were talking about earlier.
What do you mean exactly by module?
Is that the proteins? Now, sometimes you think about proteins and, you know, one view of a protein might be it's a carefully crafted full entity, and you need the whole, you know, everything is just kind of part of this fully crafted one, you know, kind of entity. The other view would be that you'd have a module of this strung to a module of that, strung onto a module of that. So it's really, those activators tend to be more of that second category, where you have a module that binds DNA, and that's just kind of tethered together via some amino acid residues, you know, via polypeptide to another module that does some, has another function that's joined together with another polypeptide. You know what I mean?
You can shuffle around?
Yeah, you can literally do that. You can literally just swap modules from different proteins. You can take a module, DNA binding module from one protein, put it in this one, and change the binding specificity. You can take the regular, you can just mix and match all these modules together in different ways, this way, you know, that way, frontwards, backwards, you know, mix them together.
Well, the question that's come up earlier is, are those correlated with exon fragments?
Not to my knowledge. It's a nice thought that Wally Gilbert would like that thought.
It would be nice, yeah.
Yeah. But to my knowledge, I think you might find a little bit of that, but I don't think as a whole it's a really clear, obvious correlation with the exons.
Modules are
what? Yeah, they're protein domains that have a specific function. Yeah.
When you swap these modules, do you have to change some amino acids to make them more stable?
No, pretty much. They're pretty independent modules. It's surprising, really surprising. I was shocked. When people started doing those experiments, I thought, these guys are idiots. But then they all worked.
So module here is just it's protein modules.
Yeah, protein modules, right.
Nothing to do with the binding.
Nothing to do with DNA, just the way the proteins are put together. It's literally just modules that are strung together. Yeah. So that's, I just thought that's kind of an interesting feature about them. It, and that they're kind of, so your average transcription factor is just kind of a bunch of modules pieced together. Okay, now this sheet here just addresses a variety of current topics in gene regulation, a few of which I'll be covering. But just to kind of give you an idea of what people are thinking about, I'm sure this is not completely all comprehensive, but these are a lot of things that do affect the transcriptional activity. I'll talk a little bit more about chromatin remodeling factors. We talked a little bit about those. Chromatin modifying enzymes, I'll get a bit more into those. This is just a complex that has, you can see a lot of different labs worked on it, and they each give it its own name. And so this factor bridges activators and the basal machinery. Okay, so it's a bridge between the enhancer binding factors and the core machinery. This is another kind of co-regulator called CBP, P300. Just two labs discovered that, you can see. There's the boundary elements, issues of elongation, regulation of the basal machinery that we talked about a bit, how enhancers work, nuclear localization. I think you might have had some of that. But we talked about the CpG methylation. Heterochromatin is a type of chromatin that doesn't condense during interphase, so as opposed to euchromatin, which is the chromatin that, in which most protein coding genes are located, and core promoter elements. Let's see here, and coupling of transcription with other processes. So these are just some issues that, not all, but I just thought it'd be nice to see a list of some of the issues that people are thinking about when they think about gene regulation, current issues, and so just something for, just again to think about. So what I'd like to do now is move on to chromatin and transcription. And this is a simple view of one thing that chromatin does for transcription. What does chromatin have to do with transcription? And so what chromatin does is that it is a global repressor of basal transcription. That is, in the absence of activators, if you don't have any activators around, you just have your basal machinery, you have your TF2D, TF2B, polymerase, F, stuff like that. In the absence of activators, chromatin represses basal transcription. And that makes some sense, because you have all your genes out there, and if your basal transcription factor, your TF2Ds and polymerases and stuff like that, can just rampantly transcribe chromatin, then all your genes will just be on all the time. Right? So you know, the idea is that your genome is put in a globally repressed state, and one thing that does that is the packing of your DNA into chromatin. We'll keep your genes off, when you want to turn a gene on, then the activators will come in and then relieve that repression of chromatin.
Is there any experiments in vitro?
Yes.
No chromatin.
Okay.
You have high activity of transcription.
Yes. If you have chromatin, maybe I'll show this a slightly different version of this here. Like in vitro, you can use what's called a chromatin template, or you can use what's called like a naked DNA template. Just no chromatin. That's people call it naked DNA. In vitro, if you have just a plain naked DNA template, and you add the basal factors, your TF2Ds and all sort of business, you get perfectly good transcription. You get very strong transcription. You package the DNA. That's what I call like an unrepressed state.
But that also depends probably how many competing sites there are.
If you just have DNA, if you have your promoter DNA, yeah. Right, you don't even need an activators or anything, right? No activators.
How many DNA you put in?
All you need is a core promoter. You just need the 40 base pairs of your core promoter.
These experiments are usually done on a 10 kilobase. They're not done on putting the whole person.
Right. No, they're just done on the plasmid. They're done typically on a plasmid.
A 10 kb or
50 kb. Yeah, just a small plasmid DNA.
So what I'm saying is there's no competing binding for the promoter.
There is not competition, though. I'd say that it still works if you did have competition. In other words, you could have, you could add other promoters if you wanted, but they'll all work. So, until you have more promoters than you have factors, then of course not all the promoters will work. But as long as provided that there are sufficient factors available, your factors being your TF2Ds and your polymerases and stuff like that, you'll get very good transcription. In other words, the Basel machinery is perfectly good at transcribing a core promoter. All it needs is the 40 base pairs of the core promoter. You'll get perfectly good transcription of that with a naked DNA template.
So all the information is at 40 base.
Yeah, that's all you need. Those 40 base pairs, core promoter, basal factors, great transcription, very robust.
The other day, I think some speakers said there are more promoter binding sites than the polymerases.
Okay, that's a separate issue. Then you will have a competition.
Right.
But still.
So maybe then the level is low in vivo is because of this reason.
Well, okay. I'll tell you that there's other evidence in favor of this. For instance, if you take histone genes and you shut down their synthesis, so if you make a histone-free like cell, then transcription goes up. That's another.
So there's 40 bases. How specific is it? So every gene has this 40 bases.
Right.
How variable?
There are different the motifs. There, like I said, there's a TADA initiating DP motif. So there are varies in the nature of the motif. But I'm just saying that a core promoter, the basal transcription process occurs readily with naked templates. Is the main conclusion. And if you do something like take a yeast cell and deplete histones, genes that are off will get turned on. Okay, there's plenty of machinery to go around. So if you have an unrepressed state, non-chromatin state, then you have perfectly good basal transcription. When you package this DNA into chromatin, then it's off. Transcription is repressed. This is at least 100-fold repression. And then when you add activators will counteract the chromatin mediated repression. So activators, in theory, could do two things. They could make just the reaction go faster. They can just make the transcription reaction go faster, the intrinsic reaction go faster. That's what I've in the past referred to as true activation. Or it can do what I used to call anti-repression, which is counteracting the repressed state. And in fact, most of what is seen as activation is in fact counteracting chromatin mediated repression.
Does it do it by actually unwinding things away from chromatin, or it sits on the chromatin and mitigates the harmful effect?
This is just a guess, but the activators combine, in contrast to the beta factors, which are blocked by chromatin, the activators, or many activators, are combined readily to chromatin. So once they're bound, they can recruit the basal factors to the template.
I see. Yeah. And the basal factors are so named because they give rise to some base rate of expression?
They're called basal factors because that's just they're just the core machinery for transcription. They're just the basic enzymes you need to make RNA. Yeah.
Is the affinity of the basal factor similar to prokaryotes? Other chromatin.
The
propensity for the basal factor to transcribe to transcribe on their own is similar to in E. coli.
I'm not sure if I would compare them in terms of affinity. In terms of efficiency, they're lower. In terms of efficiency. Yeah, and but there are so many more factors you need too. It's very different. Okay. All right. So this is kind of one of the key features of chromatin is that what chromatin does is that it maintains the genome in a repressed state, and then that the activators what they're doing is counteracting this chromatin-mediated repression. So what I really wanted to do with this was just to give you the concept that the chromatin is a repressive thing for transcription. Okay. Now, this might actually show a little better that same thing that we've talked about. This is just a model for the pathway leading to activation. The packaging of DNA and the chromatin blocks the basal transcription process, but it does not block the binding of activators to the chromatin, as we talked about. The binding activators does not require ATP or remodeling factors, but once they're bound, then if you have these remodeling factors present, then the nucleosomes will move such that now the remodeling factors, the nucleosomes flank the DNA binding factors. And this step here requires the ATP-dependent remodeling factors. This state here corresponds largely to the off state of many genes. Many genes in the off state will have various factors bound to the promoter. You'll have some rearrangement of chromatin structure, but the gene is still off. And you know, one possible reason why is that the core promoter might be would be here still inaccessible because it's in the nucleosome. What often happens is a key step in activation is that you go from this state here when the activators either don't have an exposed activation region of the factor or they don't have activation regions to here, where now all of a sudden now there's an activation region exposed, and then with that activation region you can recruit the basal machinery to the template and undergo transcription. So this is just kind of a simple model. Surprisingly, actually, it holds up pretty well for a pretty broad number of genes, this sort of idea. Many genes, and just a couple of examples of genes that fit the bill here, like there are things called nuclear receptors, like estrogen receptor. It's an activator that, it's a protein that binds to DNA. It only becomes an activator when it binds estrogens. So it doesn't activate when you don't have the estrogen. When you add the estrogens, then it has a conformational change that exposes an activation region, and then you know then you would get transcription. Other factors, many factors basically are in some form that they don't have the activation region exposed, and then when you induce them, then it becomes exposed. And that's the key, that's the difference between here and here.
Are eukaryotic transcription factors positively charged
Are eukaryotic factors positively charged? Not particularly. There's one kind of popular theory that the activation regions of eukaryotic activators is negative. But I don't think the evidence is actually all that great for that. But it's a popular thought. But there are a variety of different motifs for binding to DNA, and none of which are really all that particularly basic. Okay. Now, what I want to do, just to make sure we cover this, is to go over some of these chromatin remodeling factors and histone modifications. And so, the chromatin remodeling, so we're going to move on to talk about some of these chromatin remodeling factors, just to say a few words on those. We've already talked about them a bit, but basically they're ATP utilizing proteins, typically large multi-protein complexes that have anywhere from 2 to about 11 subunits. But the one thing they have in common is they have one ATPase subunit. And their ATPase subunits are in a really large family of ATPases, which are kind of diagrammed here. This is from a couple of different reviews that I kind of compiled this, but there are people who are good at this sort of thing, divided these ATPases into three superfamilies. And this is by this comparison of the sequences and properties and motifs in these things. And then under superfamily 2, we have these various families. And then under this one particular family, we have various subfamilies. And the factors that have been found so far to be chromatin remodeling factors come from this family here. So from either the SNF2 subfamily, SNF2L subfamily, and this other one here, this MI2 CHD34 subfamily. And so they, so basically these, and some of the sub, the ATPase subunits in these factors are called like switch 2 SNF2, STH1, I switch, and MI2 and CHD34. So one point is that these factors are members of a large family of ATPases. They have a subunit that's a member of a large, in this ATPase, large family of ATPases, and which includes other factors like helicases and things like that. Things like DNA helicases, for example.
So when you say chromatin remodeling factor, you're not including things like hats and
No, I'm not. It's kind of like a terminology or whatever, but when people say chromatin remodeling factor, what they really mean is an ATP-dependent protein that can mobilize nucleosomes. That's kind of the, whatever it is, it's the convention or whatever you want to say. Things like hats would be more like a chromatin, I guess, modifying, let's say, factor. Okay, now, these proteins are actually found in various ways, but the one that's probably the most widely studied one is called the switch SNF complex. If you go through the literature on chromatin remodeling, you'll see something called like the switch SNF complex. And the subunits of that, those were found in a couple of different genetic screens in yeast labs. And it ends up being that the ATPase sub, that particular factor has about, I think about 11 subunits to it. And the ATPase subunit is called switch 2 or SNF 2. This is, came out of one screen and this came out of another screen. So they kind of share names. These proteins alone, actually, if you look at the so-called remodeling activities of these things, these proteins alone actually have a fair amount, some activity by themselves. Also, now, this is just a list of some of those factors. It might be a little small to read, but I think you have it on your handout. And so there are these three kind of groups of these remodeling factors. One is from the switch SNF family, and there's different ones from yeast to humans. They're generally involved in gene activation. They're generally thought to be activators of transcription. People have found that some interaction between activators and these proteins, for example. So one idea is that activators might recruit these factors to... So one idea is models that activators will recruit some of these complexes to the gene, and then they facilitate mobilization of the nucleosomes. Another family here is called the I switch family. These have been found mostly biochemically by using chromatin remodeling assays. If you're interested in seeing assays, I can show you some of the assays for chromatin remodeling. You'll see that they're fairly crude, and there's a lot of room for improvement. I guess we have a lot to do. But they've been found in different processes, like this one here called NRF was found as just something that can move nucleosomes. ACF was found as something that is needed for chromatin assembly, to make chromatin. It was found as a chromatin assembly factor. Crack was just found as something that moves nucleosomes. This was found as something that helps transcription, RSF, and then this was just found as a remodeling factor that ends up being the human version of ACF. We mentioned this a little earlier, but how might these factors work? And this is just one idea. Now we have the DNA along the surface of the octamer. And so, as I was saying before, it'd be tough to take the whole DNA and just kind of slide the whole DNA at once, right? Relative to the, you couldn't really probably move the whole thing relative to the octamer surface.
Just makes one turn, or how many turns?
The DNA is wrapped about 1.8 or so, 1.8 turns when around. So if you were to just slide the DNA, it'd be, you know, if it were a concerted movement, you'd be disrupting every histone DNA contact at once. It's, you know, offhand seems unlikely. So this model is based on a couple of ideas. First off, that these factors are and that have ATPase subunit that's in the same family as things like DNA helicases that are DNA ATP-driven DNA translocating proteins. And then second, this idea that maybe instead of having the whole thing move at once, you might have a wave go by. So this is one way that these factors, if the factor came in, it might be able to motor along using the energy of ATP to motor along the DNA, like so. And then in that way, change the position of a fragment from here to here, for instance, as it motors along. So this is one idea of how these factors may work. Now, as we mentioned before, you know, how big this loop is could be variable. Maybe the DNA might turn a little bit as it depending upon how big the loop is as it goes around. But those are relatively minor details compared to the.
If you have picture. This kind of thing happening sort of independently to different nucleosomes, then you know, the spacing will be screwed up.
Well, you know. I'd say if it happened very rapidly everywhere, that you would eventually just hit some sort of equilibrium point, some low energy point. So, and I think there's good reason to think that these things could move quickly. Helicases can move 500,000 base pairs a second, I think. They're pretty fast. So they move, you know, I don't know how, and no one's actually measured how quickly these things can move. And so this is basically an untested model.
Is this happening in a 30 nanometer fiber, or is it?
It could happen in 30 nanometer fiber. It could, and again, you know, we're talking about the 30 nanometer fiber. It could might unfold and refold very rapidly. Again, most models, in fact, are something like this, though they may not have the same names. Some will say, well, the loop is too big in the other model, so my model has a small loop, or things like that. But they're all basically the same idea. It's some sort of loop. Okay. This is really one of the more common mechanisms for how they might work. It may not be right. I don't know, but it's about the best we can do right now. And I'd have to say it's essentially pretty much an untested model.
So is the red box supposed to suggest that the factor recognizes a specific...
Oh, no. What the red box is meant to be is just a particular position of the DNA showing that this moves from, it moves from here, you know, it moves from like 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock or something, sort of thing, is the basic idea.
The red box happens to be covered in the second picture.
It's just because the, you know, it's hidden underneath the remodeling factor there. Right, no, there's no.
Can it go both ways in these models?
Sure, it could potentially go the other way as well. In fact, there is reasonable evidence, unpublished, that the ACF remodeling factor does remain bound to the template DNA. Yeah, there's fairly good evidence of that. So I think these sorts of models will eventually, you know, the evidence, the unpublished data that is out there is, and what little available the other data there might be, really is pretty consistent with this sort of idea. In fact, the thing that's kind of astounding, you might wonder, like, you know, ACF is a chromatin assembly factor, so it makes nucleosomes as well. How many ATPs it takes to make a nucleosome? And the best estimates of that are 350 ATPs per nucleosome. That's about 2 ATPs per base pair. But the thing is that DNA helicases actually hydrolyze. If you just take a little study like E. coli, one of the E. coli DNA helicases, the two that I know of that have been studied, they use up 2 ATPs per base pair as well. So in other words, DNA helicases that are using 2 ATPs per base pair are using up ATP the same clip as ACF, this chromatin assembly factor or remodeling factor that's using up 2 per base pair as well. So there's a lot of energy being used, a lot of ATP being burnt up in these processes. But as a whole, you know, ATP is, there's probably about a millimolar of ATP in cells, and so there's plenty of ATP to go around, and cells are pretty good at making ATP. Now, just to give you, kind of a hint of the range of things that people will do and call it remodeling. I'll show you a few assays. The first one I need to show you is this. This is like a base assay. This is called the Michael Kaufman nuclear digestion assay. This is just a standard chromatin assay. If you ever like start going into the chromatin literature, you'll see this assay being done all the time. I thought I had printed out an actual data figure, but I don't have an actual data figure on this. But this is like what chromatin people do all the time. And so what you have here is you have the you have your nucleosome array here where the nucleosomes are somewhat periodic, and you do a partial digestion with micrococcal nuclease. Micrococcal nuclease cuts in the linker DNA between the nucleosome cores, and if you do a partial digest, you'll release the oligonucleosomal fragments. And then, so what happens is if you do a partial digest, release the oligonucleosomal fragments, deproteinize that, remove the histones, and run the DNA out on gel. And if your nucleosomes are very evenly spaced, no matter where you pick out a former, wherever you do that, the resulting DNA will be about the same length. Okay. So when you have a nice crisp ladder like that, that means you have very periodic nucleosomes. Okay. So that's something that, okay, so that's the basic assay for chromatin structure. So here's an example of one remodeling assay. So this thing here is meant to be a the nucleosome, the micrococcal ladder. So let me see if I can. What you do is you basically do, you have chromatin and you have varying, you add various things to the chromatin. For example, you might add a protein that binds the promoter. You might add your remodeling factor, and you might add ATP. Okay, so three things. So, and then you do this micrococcal digestion, and you run the DNA out in the gel, and you do what's called the Southern blot, where you can look at if you probe the blot with something that's labeled in the promoter region, then you'll get to see what the structure of the DNA is like in the promoter region. If you probe it with something that's far away from the promoter region, you just get to see what it looks like. It's like a control for something that might be not in this region. And so what this shows here is that if you add ATP only, you get a reasonable ladder. If you add your DNA binding protein only in ATP, you get a reasonable ladder. If you add the remodeling factor in ATP only, you still get a ladder. But if you add all three, if you add your factor that binds here, and ATP, and the remodeling factor, what happens is that you kind of get a smear here. So that now, instead of getting this nice periodic ladder, you get kind of a smear. And that just means that what that means literally is that the regularity of the ladder got disrupted. So when you add your remodeling factor, your DNA binding factor, and ATP, you kind of disrupt the regularity of that ladder. Okay? And you disrupt it here in the promoter region, but you don't disrupt it 2 kilobases or more away from the promoter. So it's only a local, it's a localized disruption of the regularity of the ladder.
How local? So 500 bases?
Actually, the actual region that's disrupted is probably only a couple hundred base, a few hundred base pairs.
If for some reason you ended up the disruption that produced sort of like long short in a periodic fashion, that would just be two overlay ladders. You could detect that.
You're right. This what happens is sometimes you can add a protein and it actually won't disrupt the periodicity of the ladder, and then you won't see any difference. So this assay has a lot of weaknesses to it. I've had cases where we've added proteins that have, by other assays, changed the chromatin, but did not disrupt the periodicity, and you still get the same effect. But I'm just saying this is a very commonly used assay in the field. I just call this the disruption of the array sort of assay.
What kind of DNA binding protein?
You can use any sequence-specific DNA binding protein. We'll pretty much do it. I've never seen one not work, ranging from prokaryotic DNA binding proteins to any other eukaryotic ones.
you're saying you can use the same binding protein, you can use any binding protein with a given remodeling factor, and it works, or you have to get the...
I'd say of the experiments I've seen so far, it's pretty much you cannot really pretty much sustain. Yeah, you can pretty much use any protein with any factor, pretty much. I don't think I've ever seen a really clear-cut case where you have different effects with different factors.
Is this just one binding DNA binding protein, or
It could be one. In this case, it happens to be five. I'm showing five sides here just to kind of emphasize, you know, the.
Even one can have.
One can change it. One can change it. Yeah.
And have people look at the chromatin structure, whether it's because it's disrupting the superhelical structure, or.
No, I don't think people have been looking at. And there are other ways of looking at the chromatin. Now, I'll show one other assay, or I guess two other assays. But I guess, you know, you can probably sense this is not a really precise assay. You know, and this is kind of the state of the art. Okay, so a lot of room for improvement. Yeah.
What do they use? Where do they tag the DNA? Where's the signal?
Okay, in this case, the DNA is getting labeled by this. This is a labeled thing here. So this is like a southern blot where you transfer the DNA to nitrocellulose,
right.
And then you hybridize this DNA here that's complementary.
It's right at the start site.
This particular one is at the start site near the binding site, right? Yeah.
So when you have a probe, going away from that.
When you have a probe that's near the protein binding site, you can see this disruption. But when you have a probe that's far away from where the protein binds, you don't see the disruption. Yeah.
And the only information that runs in the ladder is how the diffusion constant varies with fragment length. There's no biological information.
No, it just means that the ladder is not periodic anymore. Yeah. It's, again, this might look kind of crude. It is crude, and there's a little bit of self-criticism here too because we're not really improving on this in the field. So, but here's another one that is done occasionally that you'll see. If you ever go through the literature on this, you'll see a fair amount of this assay too. This is what I call a mononucleosome disruption assay. When you have a what happens here is that you make a mononucleosome and you treat the mononucleosome with DNase-1 this time. And, you know, since the DNase-1 cuts the minor groove of DNA, and so when the DNA is on the surface of the octamer, the minor groove, every 10 or so base pairs will be sticking out away from the histone, okay? So kind of like here in the picture, like here, if you had something like this, you have the minor groove sticking away from the octamer, right, accessible every 10 or so base pairs. And so we add DNase-1, and so we'll clip it here, 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 like that, okay? And so what happens, you get a 10 base pair ladder. So when you make a mononucleosome and the DNA is sitting on a surface with a rotation, with a specific rotational orientation, okay? If it's sitting on the DNA, if the DNA is sitting on the octamer in one specific orientation, then you'll see this. We'll see this periodic 10 base pair DNase cleavage occurring. So what happens is that, this represents the DNA sitting on the histones with, like I said, with that one rotational orientation. What happens is if you add a remodeling factor to this plus ATP, then you'll lose that kind of orientation, that specific orientation of the DNA relative to the histones, and then you lose this 10 base pair periodic cleavage pattern. Okay, so this is the 10 base pair DNase-1 ladder, and then you will lose this 10 base pair DNase-1 ladder when you add remodeling factors in ATP. To it. So this is another assay for chromatin remodeling. Again, it doesn't exactly tell you what's going on, and in fact, the DNA can still be associated. You don't even know. You don't know the DNA may or may not be still associated with the histone. You just know it's not in that one specific orientation. But this is again, this is a remodeling assay. It's commonly used, and it's quite sense that it's. Not exactly terribly precise. And then The last one I'll show is here. This one's a little more informative. This one tells you where the nucleosomes are. And so you take, this is often done in vivo, you might take nuclei and treat them with micrococcal nuclease. And then micrococcal, you do it lightly so that on the average you cut it once. And micrococcal nuclease cuts between the nucleosomes. So if you do this light digestion and then purify the DNA and cut it with a second enzyme here, you'll end up with these series of fragments, like so. You'll have the various cuts that correspond to here. And then you have this enzyme here cutting. And then you run these fragments out on the gel. And so this fragment from here to here will be this fragment. This fragment will be this fragment. That fragment will be this fragment. That fragment will be this one here. And if you probe it with this probe here, with a radio labeled probe here, these probes will light up. And the holes in between these would be where the nucleosomes would be. Okay, so that actually tells you where the nucleosomes are. So if you want to see the nucleosomes move and stuff, this is the sort of assay you do. And when someone says, yeah, I've got my promoter, and there's a nucleosome here, a nucleosome there, a nucleosome there, this is the experiment that they did to come to that conclusion. So that's another assay.
Some sort of 50 days of uncertainty.
There's a moderate amount of uncertainty there, yeah. This is not a high resolution assay. So anyway, that's pretty much, pretty much in a nutshell what is the state of the art with the remodeling factors right now. I don't know if there's any questions okay. If not, I'm just going to move on to the next issue of chromatin modifications. The last few years have been a very active area in terms of histone modifications. And there's, as I mentioned before, there's acetylation, methylation, ubiquitination, and phosphorylation as the main ones. But where a lot of the action is in the so-called histone tails. Okay, so the histone proteins, they form an octamer that's fairly globular, but coming out of the octamer are these unstructured tails. And the four core histones all have N-terminal tails, and H2H2B also have C-terminal tails. But the ones that get the most attention, the tails that get the most attention are the tails of histone H4 and H3. And so in H4, for example, positions 5, 8, 12, and 16 are lysines that are modified by acetylation. And then positions, position 20 is a lysine that's methylated in H4. Yeah. So position 20 is methylated. These are acetylated. In H3, you have 9, 14, 18, and 23. These are very well conserved positions of lysines that are acetylated. And then at position 10 and 28, you have serines that are phosphorylated. And let's see, you have methylation at 4, 9, and 27. You have methylation. So there's a lot of action going on with these different modifications, especially with the H3 and H4 tails. And these tails are conserved among all histones. I mean, these positions are very well conserved. And so you know that there's something going on that's important.
Is there a menu of a different possible acetylation, phosphorylation, so forth, or are they always?
Okay, now, these are all the different amino acid residues here. There are different ideas about, like, why, you know, is it, in other words, there's a couple different thoughts. One is that, for example, with acetylation, it could be that you're just trying to neutralize the charges on the lysines, for instance. So you might be thinking, about bulk neutralization. On the other hand, the opposite model is that, each one is important as a specific signal. In other words, there might be something that recognizes this acetylated but not this, or something that recognizes that being acetylated but not that. And so that's what I kind of have outlaid here for acetylation, but it's true for all the other, essentially true for the other things. There's a few things you can imagine that that acetylation might do. And in this case, this here says acetylation induces a conformational change in the histones. In other words, you have the lysine-rich tails. Let's say that if you have it unacetylated, the lysine-rich tails will be positively charged and associate with the DNA. So that's the basic idea. Then you acetylate those, neutralize the positive charge, and now they're less associated with the DNA, so the nucleosome is more mobile. Okay, so this is one theory of how acetylation might facilitate nucleosome mobility or facilitate transcription. Yes?
When do those chemical modifications take place?
When do they take place?
Yeah.
They take place essentially in the nucleus. There are some theories that some of them exist in the cytoplasm, but just about every factor that's been found that can acetylate a histone has been found to be nuclear. So these are nuclear proteins. And a whole bunch of those cofactors that I showed you in those various pictures, like P300 and things like that, those are factors that have this HAT activity, this acetyl transferase activity.
So it occurs after the protein is folded. So these residues are all residues that are on the outside of?
Yes, right. So you have the central globular domain, so these would be more accessible on the outside. And so, yes, it's occurring when the histones are in chromatin, if that's what you mean.
After.
Yeah. In other words, your gene is in chromatin, these factors get recruited, they come in, and then they acetylate your histones. Yeah.
Is this a permanent process?
No, it's not. There are also a whole bunch of deacetylases, too. So, I might just say a few things about there's a variety of factors have found to be acetylases. Many coactivators have been found to be these histone acetyl transferases. But even when the subunits of TF2D has this activity, the largest subunit of TF2D called TAP250. But mainly a lot of the coactivators have been found to have this histone acetyl transferase activity. A lot of the coactivators that have this activity have been found to be parts of large complexes too. You know, these 1 megadalton, 2 megadalton complexes, very, very large, complicated multi-protein complexes. I don't know why they have to be that way. It's just that the way they seem to be. Then there's a whole other family of proteins that are called. So these proteins are often called HATs for histone acetyl transferase. Though in practice, a lot of them, it's not really known whether it's actually not truly shown whether histones are the key substrate for these factors. But okay, that's another kind of point. But they're called HATs. There's also a group of proteins called HDACs, HDACs, for histone deacetylases. And so HATs tend to be activators, histone deacetylases tend to be repressors. So a lot of these factors that are called co-repressors actually have histone deacetylase activity. So it's a dynamic thing. You've got a bunch of acetylases that get recruited in by the activators. So activators the basic model is that the activators will come in and recruit these histone acetylases that come in, acetylate chromatin and make it more transcribable. And then there's a whole bunch of histone deacetylases that get recruited by repressors that come in and deacetylate chromatin and repress transcription. So that's the kind of basic model.
How do they know which ones to deacetylate?
Yeah, you know, again, we don't know. A lot of the, we have actually still, I still think we're relatively early on in terms of knowing exactly which residues get acetylated, which residues get deacetylated, and things like that.
Where in a genome? Which section?
Just locally. This all happens locally within near the promoters. So like if you have a factor that's a histone acetyl transferase, that will come in and, you have your activator. That will recruit a histone acetyl transferase, and then that will locally, maybe within a plus or minus a half kilobase or so, locally acetylate your promoter. likewise, deacetylases will locally deacetylate in the promoter region too.
But when these guys are repressed, when the lysines are binding to the DNAs, if you do this experiment you mentioned before with the remodeling factors, do you have an idea of how immobile they become?
No. In other words, is this really true? Is maybe in other words, how less mobile is this relative to this? To my knowledge, the mobility is people have not really observed much of a difference in mobility between these. This may or may not be true. Actually, this is just a model. It's a model that makes sense, but it may be true to some extent. But to be honest, actually, more of the data is pointing in this direction. The acetylation is a signal. So that what happens is that the acetylation event is not so much maybe to the other, this is a different viewpoint, they can all be true, but another viewpoint of what acetylation should be doing is that acetylation is not there to neutralize lysine, but is there to provide a signal for something else to recognize that signal and act upon it. As you know, in a lot of signaling, there's a phosphorylation is a key thing in a lot of signaling pathways. You know, all these signaling pathways involve a lot of phosphorylation events. And people aren't saying, oh, phosphorylation is there to make the protein more negative. No, it's really there because there's another protein that recognizes the phosphoprotein. And in the same way, I think that there's going to be a lot of this sort of thing happening where you'll find that we're finding that the evidence is favoring this sort of, there's a lot of good evidence now in favor of this sort of model that the acetylation is really more of a signal than a new charge neutralizing means of neutralizing the charge. And so sorts of evidence in favor of that is if you look at these different residues and how they're distributed in different genes, actually, there's very distinct patterns of acetylation at each of these specific sites. Some sites, in fact, even correlate with repression. You know, acetylation at certain sites. So acetylation ends up being very important, exactly where you're acetylating. And so this model is kind of really rapidly gaining favor. Sometimes people call it the histone code idea, that there's a code. In other words, the kind of model is that there's a code in the histones based on that is read by other factors, is the way that it's kind of promoted as. So, but the basic idea is that there's a difference between where you, it makes a difference where you acetylated it. And so, and that there may be other factors that recognize the specific acetylation.
That was my earlier question. Oh, okay. If you're using this as a signal, then uh-huh. What is directing whatever acetylation?
What recognizes that signal?
Well, no, not what recognizes, but what directs the acetylase to acetylate.
Okay, it's the enzyme itself. The enzymes, the acetylase enzymes themselves do have this. They do have specificity.
Okay, but there's so many histones around, how does it know which one to local? Yeah.
Okay, so what keeps the histones, okay, why doesn't it just do everything everywhere?
Yeah.
Okay, but is that the activator proteins, like the promoter binding factors, enhancer binding factors, will recruit these factors to the promoter region, and then in fact those factors will be localized to the promoter region and just acetylate in that area.
But then according to that's again the passive sort of kind of I guess what I'm asking is where is the information? If you're going by this binding protein, then the information is in the DNA. But
right,
if you use this as a code, then it's another.
Okay, well, I'm not the one who calls it the code, but the original source of the specificity, what originally brings the acetylase to the promoter is the sequence in the DNA. Because it goes, starts with the sequence, then your promoter binding factor binds that sequence, and then it brings in this protein. So that's the source. So the original source in this model, the original source of what brings it there is the DNA sequence, the cis sequence. Yeah. So anyway, this is a This is something that's gaining favor.
Yes. People mutate these positions and see what happens.
Yes, you can. You can do that in yeast. Many organisms, like humans, have many, many copies of the histone gene, so you can't really do a good kind of genetic analysis. If you mutate one gene, you've still got a whole bunch of other genes to deal with. In yeast, they've had, it's somewhat complicated, but you do see these sorts of effects. For instance, you'll see mutation of certain lysine residues have an effect on certain processes, but only that lysine residue. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. So you do see that. Another thing that sometimes I see things, I might just point out maybe semi-parenthetically that these tails also have some redundancy. There's some redundancy in their function. If you knock out one of these, this one will kind of do the whole job. If you knock out this guy will take care of the job too. So there's a little bit of duplication of function there. But even in the case when you have both tails, for instance, this position here is very important for a phenomenon called silencing, where you turn off, there's a certain set of genes that get turned off in that process, and that's the most important, that residue you need for that process. I think overall, like I said, the data are coming not exactly at a rapid pace, but this is a sort of, model seems to be being consistent with most of the data. But like I said, also, if you look at, you can make antibodies against each of these specific residues as well. So you can tell whether or not like certain genes have this guy or this guy or this guy or this guy. And again, you find very non-random patterns of where each of these exists. Like I said, sometimes some of these positions, like here, correlates more with repression, whereas the other ones correlate with activation, for instance. And so again, that suggests that it's not just simple neutralization that's occurring. Another thing that I mentioned briefly is that these enzymes, which are called histone acetyltransferases, also have been found to acetylate non-histone proteins too, like transcription factors. So it's entirely possible that there are other proteins that are the targets of some of these histone acetyltransferases too. So when you get into the literature of that, another thing to consider is that for some of these proteins, the histones may not even be the actual target, or the key target for some of these acetyltransferases. So you want to keep an open mind about exactly what's getting modified by these enzymes. So that's the third thing I think just to keep in mind, that even though they're called HATs, the histones are great substrates for these. It could be that other proteins are also the key targets. So incidentally, I just might mention it there. One protein that has kind of a dual function is this MI2CHD2 family. This complex here, there's a complex called NERD that has both, it actually has both remodeling activity and a deacetylase activity. So that's a case where you have both of those sorts of in one complex. That was one thing that's a little novel about that. This is something that has both, this complex called NERD with the MI2 ATPase in it. Actually, it has this MI2CHD protein, the ATPase, and it has a histone deacetylase subunit as well. So this is a complex that has both. Okay, well, regarding acetylation, I think those are the current questions that we have in acetylation. Now they're going to be, I think there'll be, you can probably see a wave of papers on methylation coming out pretty soon too. That's kind of the next thing. But a lot of similar things will arise. Is methylation a signal for something else and things like that? And so those are sorts of, I think a lot of similar questions will come up. Is it histones that are the key substrate for these? I think all those same questions will arise with the with the histone methyl transferases. One thing that I thought that people might have had a little bit of interest in is this issue of enhancer function. But to move on, other kind of related questions that also kind of have a chromatin theme to it. There are some questions, there are a lot of questions here that I think that we don't know about how enhancers work. So this is just a, shows you various things. These are various motifs that can affect transcription. So here we have our core promoters. You have your enhancers here. And you have the boundary elements. Boundary elements are things that seem to be able to block the influence of an enhancer, or in fact, either activating or repressive things. So in other words, if you have two boundary elements flanking something, then this would be like a domain here, and this enhancer's influence would be limited, confined to this domain.
How does that work?
We don't know yet how they work. Boundary elements have been found to be binding sites for sequence-specific DNA binding factors. There are a handful, but three particularly well-characterized boundary elements so far. And each of those three has been found to have DNA binding factors, that sequence-specific DNA binding factors that bind to them, typically in multiple copies of a sequence-specific DNA binding factor. And how those factors function to block is not known. You know, various models and ideas might be that it might be attachments to some sort of nuclear structure or something, or a bigger structure, for example, these ideas like scaffolds and matrices and stuff like that. That may or may not be true. So people don't really know how these work, but these factors, they're becoming much better defined, these boundary elements.
How long are they?
Half kilobase, maybe, something like that, yeah.
You can trim it down to?
No, because they typically have multiple binding sites for a factor. Also, they're still somewhat unpredictable. You might have a case where a boundary element might work really well as a boundary element, and then you might duplicate it, and then it doesn't work anymore. Okay, all right. You know that. I mean, things like that happen. Okay, you know these are phenomena that just are not really nailed down yet.
What's the spacing between them?
Well, naturally occurring bonding on. There are very few known, so I really can't generalize on that. There really aren't any. I can't really think of any locus where you have. Typically, what you might see, you know, the basic models that you might have a locus with a gene in it or a couple of genes in it, and then there might be boundary elements flanking the locus.
That's, know what the pattern is, or how do they?
The pattern would be that it'd be flanking the locus. Then I guess, if you know what I mean. Yeah. However big the locus may be.
But they do assign some function to them, so they must know that something binds to them, or.
The way that people usually test these is that you just take a DNA sequence and you pop it in between a promoter and an enhancer and see if it blocks it or not.
Take one of these boundary elements.
Yeah,
and stick it
right.
In nice.
Yeah, that's a typical assay, like an enhancer blocking assay sort of thing. And so that's how people start to find them and characterize them. Now, you might ask, one thing you might say is, well, how do you distinguish between a boundary element and a silencing element? And so, ideally what you would do is you would also show that it blocks a repressive element, too. In other words, you can show that it blocks not only the action of an activator, like an enhancer, but also the action of a repressor.
These little stop signs, do they symbolize like proteins that are bound?
No, that represents it's a boundary element. It's saying, you know, stop your influence, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are they asymmetric?
To my knowledge, they're
on one side but not the other.
To my knowledge, they work bidirectionally. Yeah, the ones I know of, anyway. you can flip them around and they'll work. The one problem is that, again, you know, these are things where the level of study is relatively new, and so you get these surprises, like I'm telling you, that duplication thing. You know, you just don't, you end up with a lot of ad hoc explanations at that point, you know, once you start getting something like that. But nowadays, when people, there's a practical application of these, like in gene therapy, or in when you want to make transgenic animals and stuff, you might, sometimes if you just take an enhancer, if you just take a piece of DNA and stick it in, it can be influenced by the locations called position effects, where the DNA gets put into the genome could influence the expression of your gene. But if you have your transgene flanked by these boundary elements, then that would kind of insulate it from the the position effect, from any surrounding sequences when you stick transgenes into animals. So that's one kind of application of that, of these things.
So they don't have anything to do with like brush formation or anything during.
Right now I'd say the evidence just argues that they're binding sites for factors that block the influence of something by some means. It could just be, you know, just having enough of those factors that just stops the tracking of some molecule down there. It's not really known. You know, these things, we're still really kind of in the early stages of understanding these. Okay, so these are, that's an enhancer. One issue is that here's like two different models for enhancer promoter specificity. So this is just, again, just to show you some ideas of what people think about. There are two models. One is this. One model is that how might you obtain an specificity for enhancer. We talked about this before. Enhancers can be located really far away from promoters. So how do enhancers know which promoter to work with? So here you have two core promoters, and you have an enhancer here with a choice of two different core promoters, and it's picking this one here on the left. In this upper model, what you have is you have the establishment of a specific enhancer core promoter interaction. And in fact, there is evidence for this type of effect. Another model for which there's also in different contexts evidence is that boundary elements could also function in the same capacity. In other words, if you have an enhancer here and you have two core promoters to choose from, if you just put a boundary element here, right, this guy can't go that way, but he can go this way. So these are just ideas about how enhancers might work to match up with their core promoters. Yes?
These boundary elements, are they specific to the sequence of the enhancer? So would a boundary element work for any enhancer, or do they come in pairs?
They seem to work pretty independently. So it's not so much the pairing of that with the enhancer, it's just, they seem to be pretty independent, work pretty independently. Another thing is that I might mention is that they're not as on-off as this picture might signal. It's several-fold repression, you know, it's a maybe tenfold or so, you know, effect. It's not a black-white, you know, boundary that you usually see.
Is there a few sort of universal types of these boundary elements, or are there many?
There are a few that are fairly well characterized.
And the binding sites are known?
The binding sites are known, the factors that bind to them are known.
Okay.
Yeah, so there are three that are pretty well known, where you know the cis site, you know the trans factor.
How long is the binding site?
Each of the individual binding sites might range from maybe around 10 to 20 or something. Not that long. Yeah.
Is stuff in between the binding sites conserved at all, or not
enough example? No. It's typically multiple binding sites for a factor, for a trans factor.
All the exons are between these, right? I mean, the gene is...
Yeah, exactly. You would have some exons here, for instance. Your coding region would be here.
So there won't be an exon way over...
No, yeah. At least not by the kind of canonical models. Now, again, I just want to show you some things, issues, just so that these are all kind of current issues. This is one question about enhancer function. What happens when you see an increase in transcription in the population of cells? If you have an enhancer get turned on, a couple things might be happening as it gets turned on. Either that, this just represents the amount of transcription. So either that all the cells are going to kind of gradually get more transcription, or just the proportion of cells transcribed is increased. And believe it or not, actually both of these have been seen. So sometimes people will just kind of you do an experiment, you kind of just measure the amount of RNA you get in the total population of cells, and you say, fine, I got more RNA, my gene went up. But it could, sometimes it's worth thinking about whether or not your gene went up because they all went up, or just because the fraction of those that went up. So again, these are just kind of issues that people think about when they think about how enhancers work. Now, one thing I do have to say about this, if you have a unicellular organism that has to get a gene turned on, you can't go, that's not going to cut it, But maybe in other cases, multicellular organisms that might. And then the last thing I have here in the enhancer section is this, where how might enhancers find their promoters? And this is just a model again. It's just, but again, it's consistent with most available data, is that you might have your factors bind to the enhancer, and then these DNA binding factors tend to be the sorts of factors that are multimers, so they can actually bind to more than one DNA at once. So what happens here in this picture, this thing just flips over, and then it's got a specific interaction here and a non-specific interaction here. And then, as I guess you were talking about yesterday, you can imagine this scanning along the DNA, for instance. Let's ignore the chromatin. And it's going to scan along the DNA until it finds a match here. That's one idea of how enhancers might find the quark model. Yes?
So do you really have evidence, say, you have this complex formed and then the motion at the same time bending the DNA, or they just move there and cause the bending later? The sequence here is indicating you have a complex form first and then bending the DNA at the same time and moving.
You mean this thing?
Right.
All this is really meant to be is that I'm not really so much concerned about the bending as just that it's making a second contact with the DNA. That's non-specific. This is not a specific interaction here. This is not a sequence-specific interaction. It's just that, remember that these sorts of factors can have multiple, these are typically multimers that could potentially bind to multiple DNAs. And so they have a lower affinity for, of course, non-specific DNA, but, could, in fact, have the potential to track. Again, this model is consistent with a variety of different experiments that have been performed, on enhancer function. It makes some sense. Again, it's just a current model, I think, for how enhancers work. May or may not end up proven true or not, but these are, I just thought I'd try to present some of these current ideas. Yes?
Did people try to vary the length between the enhancer binding site and the promoter, sort of as to sort of change the probability that the enhancer bound to the enhancer site sort of will actually reach the promoter and then sort of...
Yeah, as you increase the length, the enhancers will still work, but they will become not as strong if you increase it from the natural length. So enhancers, you can move them pretty far back and they'll still work, but it will go down, but the magnitude of activation you get will go down.
Okay. And did people try to compare them to the probability of random walks of returning to?
I don't think so. And part of the thing is that probably not all DNA is the same. Some of it, depending upon what DNA you put in between, can affect that too. You know what I mean? The efficiency of an enhancer. So, in other words, all DNA has some sort of activity to it. So if you insert DNA between here and here, if you insert sequence A, you might get one effect. If you insert sequence B at the same distance, you might get a a different effect, you know, a slightly different effect. So in terms of exactly quantitate that, it may not be such a useful thing to do, because just the amount of variation you get depending upon what sequence you put in. That's something that's always very difficult, is that there's no neutral DNA. So whenever you're working with DNA, you know, anything that has to do with DNA, you just can't put any generic, you know, everything you put in is going to do something, whatever sequence you put in. And so unfortunately, there's just no completely bland DNA that we can use.
But you can also do a control experiment by introducing some other artificial part and use the same piece of DNA and try to measure the probability of enclosing.
You can do...
You can basically try to introduce another, use the same DNA you did here, and then basically measure actually what's the probability is it going to loop and...
Use the same DNA in a different... Well... No, okay. Well, if you have the same DNA sequence, you can compare what goes on between the same sequence, if that's what you mean. You can use, if you swap different DNA sequences, I think that would be, again, you know, DNA sequences are not neutral, so it is a difficult comparison.
In this kind of model, whether people do it monochromatin
in between
the nucleosome?
I think, this model, of course, doesn't have any nucleosomes there. Personally, if you want my opinion, I suspect that proteins can track readily through chromatin.
Okay.
Track readily through chromatin. One thing that I didn't show here that I talked about a little bit in
this banding that will be hard if the chromatins are forming this superhelical structure.
Right. I'm trying to find my picture of the 3-nanometer fiber. Here it is. Here's the native structure of chromatin. One thing that sometimes isn't often mentioned in textbooks is that the bulk of your chromatin in interphase nuclei is in this form here. It's in this 30-nanometer diameter filament. When you look at, like, if you go to a textbook and you tell what chromatin looks like, you'll see beads on a string, nucleosomes like that. That's not the normal form of chromatin. The natural form of your chromatin is this folded structure. This is just one particular model for the structure. Actually, no one actually knows what the structure of the 30-nanometer diameter of chromatin filament is. This is a popular model for it, but other models are right now equally as possible. But the fact is that this is the native form. And so what Terry is kind of getting at is, if you're trying to imagine something tracking through here, how are you going to have proteins tracking along the DNA through here? It's, at one level, it's kind of hard to imagine, but at the same time, I actually suspect that this is a dynamic enough structure that it can accommodate the tracking.
But also the bad thing,
It seems like an awful hard thing to do, but when you look at the properties of a lot of these things, they really are, I just think it's, you know, if I take a guess, I think it's tracking, and I think that this structure is not as kind of imposing as it really looks. You know, it looks like something you just can't, looks like it's impossible to make your way around this, but I think it's probably much more flexible and accommodating than you might guess from just, you know, looking at it this way. I could be wrong, but...
In this case, what is the size of the transcription factor? What is the...
The protein part of a nucleosome is about 120 kilodaltons. And so your average sequence-specific DNA binding factor might be about the same mass. Lots of times they're multimers. Your polymerase machinery is over half a megadalton. So that's much bigger than this.
Something in the same size of one of these beads has to walk on this.
It would definitely disrupt the structure. Okay, it would definitely disrupt that. You could not have both the DNA and your factor there at the same time. So this thing would have to unfold, as your factor goes by, and then it would, you know, and then refold after it goes by. So it'd have to unfold and refold. It, you know, again, it seems like, you know, it seems like an awful, you know, lot to have to do. But you know, I could be 100% wrong about this, but I think that's what it's doing. I think that it's unfolding and refolding. There is some data, electron microscopy data, showing like polymerase is traversing a 30-nanometer fiber, and you can see the polymerase moving along, and behind the polymerase is a 30-nanometer fiber, in front of the polymerase is a 30-nanometer fiber, which means that it's unfolding and refolding as the polymerase is moving. So if a polymerase can move by and have this unfolding and folding occur just right, you know, with the speed of the polymerase, I don't see why other proteins can't do that either.
But polymerase produce ATP, interesting.
Yes, yeah, it is an ATP, it's a nucleotide-driven motor, so it does have extra means of doing that. On the other hand, you know, there are these ample amounts of nucleosome mobilizing activities and things like that. So again, I could be completely wrong about this, okay? But I think that the way a lot of these factors work, though, is by actual sensing and tracking of the DNA sequence. Otherwise it would miss the promoter. You know, how would you even find the core promoter if you couldn't sense it kind of base pair by base pair? You would never find a core promoter. You'd never find your sites. You'd have to, you know, how these things would, I don't think we'd ever find a core promoter if it couldn't, you know, if it was just jumping along here, you're going to miss that 40 base pairs. So I think it really has to sense it. That's just, you know, that's just more of a intuition or guess or whatever.
But dynamically, are these constantly histones moving and melting?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Just by itself?
I think so. Yeah.
Is that possible? The promoter region actually is always in the linker instead of?
Possible, probably unlikely given the, what's known about chromatin structure around there, that you typically find, you don't find them in linker regions. Yeah. So it's not something, it's not observed. So again, these are all kind of questions, and you know, I don't know, maybe, I hope some people would have, you know, you guys can come up with better ideas or better experiments or something, but there are a lot of things that we don't know. Even something as fundamental as what is the structure of this fiber is not known. In other words, what is the structure of our chromatin at interface is not known. We don't know that. We don't know what the structure this is.
No crystal structure.
No, you can't. It's too uneven to do. It's too big for crystal structures and too uneven, and it's too small for standard, you know, microscopy.
People do these experiments with DNA where they just compactify it so tightly that you get like a liquid crystal sort of alignment of all of the things. You could probably do that with something like
You might, yeah, sure.
Hopefully
there'd
be some registry.
Maybe, yeah. Sure. I'm just, you know, these are really basic, you know, questions about what our genome is like, and we don't know. So there are really a lot of, like I said, there are a lot of unanswered things, and this is one of them, and it's something I wish we really knew a lot more about. And you know, like you said, there are all these questions about how do factors find their site, you know, in this chromatin. We don't know. And I can only give you my guesses or maybe intuition about it.
Are there also other factors that are
sitting on? Well, in a gene, there would be a lot. It would be spotted with a lot of different factors. So that would.
But the gene is fine
with
none of the
intergenic
space.
So it's at one level. I think, you know, you can. I think we've made. There've been a lot of progress in the field, but on the other level, there are just a lot of things that. We really don't have much of a clue about right now, and it's, you know, just nature of the business. Hope is that there can be you know, a lot more progress in the future, especially as other people you know, can get involved in these sorts of areas and think about these sorts of questions. I think that new approaches and new ideas are always what we really need sometimes. So. Okay, I think that's about.
Do you know how rigid this device
is? I don't think it's that rigid, and I don't think there's really much known about that in terms of in terms of biophysical studies, yeah.
Is there a way to assay the affinity between a particular sequence of DNA and the histone?
The affinity between a sequence and histone.
And how long you need to for the DNA in order to do that kind of assay?
Let's see. I mean, an individual histone's affinity for the sequence. For the most part, they don't have much. Histones don't really exhibit much sequence specificity for binding the DNA.
They're associated in the solution, in free solution.
The association of histones, like free histones, like are you thinking like individual histones, for example?
You
get a very strange interaction. If you take purified individual histones and DNA, what you'll see is I think it's not physiological, but you get kind of this 10 base pair repeating ladder. They must form dimers and bind to the DNA in some way. It's a very strange interaction with a free individual histone of DNA. And I don't know, I kind of doubt that it's going to be that particular observation is going
to... Yeah, but it would be nice if you can have a way to assay this kind of affinity, because it might be all those promoter region actually has a much weaker interaction with the histone, so they are much more, relatively speaking, floppy and exposed more often to the solution than other kind of sequence.
So far, to our knowledge, there's probably not going to be a difference in that affinity. I think it's an interesting idea that you're going to have that promoters might be, but I don't think there's any evidence in favor of that right now. Well, maybe some evidence against that idea. Yeah. Yes?
So I want to return to this question of whether there's any specific interactions between activators and chromatin remodeling factors or paths or anything like this.
Okay, right.
I've heard people say, for example, that switch SNP is essential for transcription of 5% of yeast genes, but only 5%, which sort of suggests something specific. I mean, is that...
Yes, and the model is that, I might not have been completely clear about this, but it's been proposed that the activators, that sequence-specific DNA binding factors, like enhancers and binding factors, will recruit switch-SNF factors to promoters.
Right.
Okay, that's been proposed, and there's some evidence of switch-SNF binding to some activators, but not other activators, sort of thing.
Okay, yeah. I thought you said earlier that sort of any activator will recruit a given...
I meant that in a different context, yeah, okay. So going back to this sort of picture here, I've tried to make the lines kind of fit some of the things. For instance, here are activators trying to recruit the chromatin remodeling factors to the thing. There are also repressors recruiting in histone deacetylase complexes. There are activators recruiting. These are HATs. These are histone acetyltransferases. Here, like so. So those are many of the proposed connections between these different things.
So you think that there are certain activators that go and get certain remodeling factors?
I'd say that there is reasonable evidence in favor of that. Uh-huh. It's not like really nailed down, but I'd say there's reasonable evidence in favor of that. And you know, you might have to ask, well, also, you know, what do you need first, what do you need second, and things like that. And people are starting to address those sorts of questions too. Do you need both HATs and remodeling factors, or if you need both, which one acts before the other, and things like that. And people are just starting to get that sort of information. I wouldn't be surprised if different genes give you different answers to those sorts of questions too. So, you know, so that there may be as many answers as there are genes, almost, in a sense. I'm not sure if there's going to be one general answer for all those things. And, you know, maybe some genes may not need all these factors as well, right? So some genes may need some subset and some may not. You know, something. So it's, again, this is, it's a bit of a, like I said, it's a, at one level, it's kind of complicated, but another level, I think it was still within grasp of, I think, understanding.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's thanks, Jen.
Lots of questions.